From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.
On this week's show, how a bicycle trip in Haiti impacted orphans in the Kansas City area.
Poverty in this country is associated with broken families, not because poor people are more broken than anyone else. It's just that they have less resources to mask their brokenness.
Plus, a class at Fort Leavenworth teaches the Islamic code of Sharia.
Some things that I say or do in class can make a life or death difference in a situation that I couldn't possibly now foresee.
And constructing an altar is part of Kansas City's celebration of the Day of the Dead.
People that are coming into the space can also add their own memories to it, and I think that's going to help people connect, even if they're unfamiliar with this celebration.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news. This is Casey Currents. I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
In recent years, there's been a concerted push at local and national levels to make healthy food more widely available, particularly in low-income areas. This is one focus of National Food Day, which local food groups and advocates celebrated across the U.S. last week. But as KCUR's Alana Gordon reports, while programs and systems are gradually putting fresh food front and center, changing actual eating habits can be more complicated.
For several years now, local leaders have been opening farmers markets, urban farms, and other projects focused on improving overall health and access to food. They see National Food Day as a way to recognize the ongoing efforts. Some civic leaders and food advocates met at Juniper Gardens in Kansas City, Kansas this week to kick off the occasion.
Yeah, let's get everybody just kind of... Because it's such a great view.
Mayor Joe Reardon and others scrunched together for a photo at the corner of this large urban training farm. It's 8 acres and surrounded by public housing. Mayor Reardon explains that to him, Food Day is about raising awareness about the importance of healthy food and getting back to its roots, so to speak, like to that of his great-grandparents who first moved to this area as farmers.
Fast forward to me, and that experience is much more removed, and my kids don't have that connection to farming at all in the same way. And so we have to revisit that, and we have to orient ourselves again to the importance of that.
But in a county like this one, where 32,000 residents live in areas with poor access to a grocery store and fresh produce, how well is this message catching on? Reardon says the process has been organic, as urban farms like this one work to supply fresh produce all over the metro and to the neighborhoods right here.
So it means that, you know, the homes that are around here, when you open your door now, it's not a weeded lot anymore that was abandoned. There's a farm right outside your door, right in the middle of our city. And so that's happening not just here. This is a significant and an impactful one in the size of it. But we're seeing that now springing up in every neighborhood.
And let me walk you to this one over here. It's an edible plant that you can eat, and it's a flower.
After Reardon and others leave the farm, Kansas City, Kansas resident Judith Smith comes over. She shows me the community plot that she and other families have been cultivating
tomatoes,
here over the last 2 years.
Potatoes, basil, we have a lot of herbs, spices.
Smith says before the farm started up here, local produce and produce in general wasn't a part of her mindset.
I was eating greasy food that wasn't healthy, you know, from the can, and now I won't eat nothing but salads. Nothing with fat, like fried chicken, nothing like that.
Smith says her transformation came easily.
What changed for me was learning how to plant vegetables, and then we went to a farm, and I got to see how different people were doing different things, and I didn't know plants was edible. I'm like, ooh, yuck, that's grass, but it's actually edible vegetables out there. You can just walk up and just eat in the garden.
So it really took you seeing it to then connecting to...
Exactly, because I was like, I'm not going to get on my knees and do anything. But once I started doing it and tasting it, I like it.
Smith is involved with a lot at Juniper Gardens now, from doing cooking demonstrations to working with parents and kids on garden plots. What she's learned is people really connect with seeing her pick vegetables right on site and then showing how they can be cooked.
We see people like pulling to the side and getting out, like, what's this, what's that, what are you cooking, and we'll tell them. And we're like, don't say you don't like it, try it. So now we're getting more people down here, even more kids than adults.
But drawing a crowd isn't always an easy process.
Yeah, I'm sorry it's not more exciting.
About 5 miles south of Juniper Gardens, Eugene Brown wraps up a Sunday morning farm stand on the corner of 29th Street and Strong Avenue.
It feels like a failing effort today.
Just a handful of people have stopped by this morning. The market Brown operates is a mobile one. It's part of a program called Beans and Greens, and it travels to different sites throughout the metro at set times, selling fresh food at a discount for food stamps. Brown said he's learning that finding the right time and place for these markets can be a challenge, even when they're in neighborhoods like this one with no grocery store. He says one reason he's parked here is there's a big church across the street. When things get slow, sometimes he'll take measures into his own hands.
Once in a while, what we'll do is we'll run over to the church, and as people come out of the church, we'll kind of hound them, which is kind of bad because we're standing there next to the Father. We're like, you don't mind if we stand next to you, do you? And so we try and get some of the people that come out of the nearby church to come over and shop. But in the fall at this time, it is kind of feast or famine.
But Brown says don't let this slow day fool you. Sales at this mobile market and others have actually grown this year. Like with Smith at Juniper Gardens, he sees hands-on guidance making a difference. Brown says kale is a great example.
I can't count the number of customers that came through the mobile market this year, and if I had to make a broad generalization, or between low 20s and mid-30s, that had no idea what kale was. They thought it was a green, and they were getting ready to cook it like a green by throwing a ham hock in it or something else. We ultimately had to educate them on some real healthier ways to eat kale. And so it was a long process. It wasn't an easy sell, whether it was handing a recipe, following up, trying it, even in some instances offering kale as, you know what, since you bought all that here, just take one as a freebie, try it, come back, talk to us about it. And once they realized it, then of course, it was fantastic.
Brown says costs can be a challenge for people. But he says a bigger question for the market and other initiatives is whether these new experiences and eating habits will stick. Alana Gordon, KCUR News.
This story was produced with Harvest Public Media, a reporting collaboration of KCUR and other public media stations in the country. Thirty years ago, the Toy and Miniature Museum of Kansas City opened its doors, housing dollhouses, toys, and miniatures mostly collected by two Kansas City women. The museum is making plans for the future with a new name and a new look, as KCUR's Laura Spencer reports.
The Toy and Miniature Museum is housed in a 1911 mansion atop a hill at the end of a long driveway across from the UMKC School of Law. The museum is closed on this day, so inside it's quiet as educator Laura Taylor walks along a hallway to a glass case nestled in a blue background. It's the most recent miniature commissioned by one of the founders, Barbara Marshall.
When she finds an artist that she believes in, she ask them what they'd like to make. And so many of the works in our collection are pieces that are the artist's dream works. In this case, the artist actually asked Mrs. Marshall, well, what would you like? And she said, you know, I'd really like a jewelry store from a great age of jewelry design.
This Art Deco jewelry store, designed by Mulvaney and Rogers, is at 1/12th scale. Tiny necklaces, brooches, and earrings with precious and semi-precious stones sparkle on black velvet and glass cases. There's a salesman and a couple, the woman in an elegant green suit and fur, the man in a gray-striped double-breasted suit. There's also a wedding cake-style beaded chandelier.
There are 15,800 beads in the chandelier.
The two museum founders, the late Mary Harris Francis and Barbara Marshall, were childhood friends and avid collectors. Marshall started collecting miniatures in the 1950s. Francis started her toy collection with dollhouses in the early 1970s.
They used to show their treasures to Mary Harris Francis's mother, and she told them that if they got one more thing, they were going to have to open a museum. And that resonated with them. So in 1982, they did decide to pool their collections and open the Miniature Museum, which was the original name of the Toy and Miniature Museum.
Director Jamie Barry says the two women continued to collect and outgrew this space quickly. In 1989, an expansion tripled the size of the museum. Another renovation in 2002 made room for the loan of an extensive marble collection, considered one of the largest in the world. There are 38 rooms full of tea sets, classic games, mechanical toys, teddy bears, dollhouses, curiosity miniatures, and more.
People are interested in having a little bit of a nostalgic trip when they come here and seeing things that they played with.
The museum's Laura Taylor says most of the toy collection dates to the 19th century, when attitudes about childhood were changing. Standing next to the largest object in the collection, the 9-foot-tall, 7-foot-wide Coleman dollhouse, Taylor says the nature of play has also changed over time.
The dollhouse today, it has more to do with family relationships. 100 years ago, 150 years ago, that certainly was the case, but there was also a sense of learning skills that you would need as an adult.
Staying in touch with what adults and children want out of the museum today is something that director Jamie Barry says the staff and board have been focused on with extensive research since she was hired in 2005.
One of the things that we've continued to hear about the museum is that we're a well-kept secret, and frankly, we're tired of that. We would like to be better known.
Barry says the 30th anniversary of the museum provided an opportunity to make a leap from a regional museum to one more in the national spotlight. To that end, they're unveiling a new name, the National Museum of Toys and Miniatures.
We'll be rolling out some new exhibit designs and some new interpretation that will hopefully evoke some of the feelings and emotions that kids experience today when playing with things, but still using, in many respects, our existing collection of antique toys.
Laura Spencer, KCUR News.
For more about the newly named National Museum of Toys and Miniatures, and to hear about one of the smallest works in the collection, a pair of dressed fleas, check out our website at kcur.org and click on Arts and Culture.
This next story is about an unconventional program that addresses the complicated problem of how to deal with foster care. Adopt KC grew out of an organization called the Global Orphanage Project and a bunch of professional men who took a life-changing bike trip to Haiti. KCUR's Laura Ziegler talked to Tate Williams, who started Adopt KC and was also involved in the Global Orphanage Project's tour to Haiti.
Haiti may have receded from the front pages of the news, but restoration from the 2010 earthquake goes on. In the last week, Hillary and Bill Clinton were there encouraging sustainable development with investment capital. A new documentary tells the story of one local group which sought to learn more about Haiti and engage with the people there, particularly the many orphans, by bicycling around the country. The Global Orphan Project and Go Adventures decided to take bicycles to the orphans along the way and found they learned more from the people there than they were able to give back.
There's still an internal struggle, an internal wrestling that I don't have an answer to right now that creates a material tension that I don't know what to do with and I don't have a good answer to. And I think most men on this kind of trip that have more wealth than they know what to do with, to figure out how to handle that.
But the lessons have had a local spinoff.
Essentially, the Global Orphan Project working in Haiti is now working here in Kansas City as well.
Tate Williams is running the program Adopt KC. What is the connection between the tour to Haiti, as it was called, and Adopt KC?
The connection there is the Global Orphan Project partners with local indigenous churches to care for children in their community. And then we provide avenues for people to go experience and see what the local people are doing on behalf of local children. When you hear the word orphan, most people think Haiti, Uganda, developing world. The reality is here in the U.S., in the child welfare system, there's roughly about 500,000 children at any given point in time, if you were
nationwide,
to take a cross-section nationally. In Kansas City, today, there's roughly about 3,500 children in the Metroplex, so both sides of the state line, out of home care, foster care. So in our definition, as the Global Orphan Project, when we ask the question, who is an orphan? And we have to ask this question in every country we work. The answer for us is not, do they have biological living relatives? The answer is, do they have someone who's willing and able to parent them? In the U.S., we've got over 100,000 children who are waiting adoption. We age out about 350 children annually who at 18 go onto the streets of our city, the Kansas City Metroplex.
Let me go back to the Global Orphan Project.
Yes.
And you think of a country like Haiti, which is widely considered among the poorest, if not
right,
the poorest in the Western Hemisphere, compared with the United States, which is obviously the richest.
Right.
Isn't it apples and oranges to talk about orphans there and foster care kids here. I mean, the starting points are so different for these kids.
Yeah, and that's a misconception, I think, that a lot of folks have. A lot of folks attribute the issue of orphan, quote unquote, to poverty, when in reality it's not. Orphans exist because of no one who's willing to parent them. So here in the U.S., the children who wait, who age out, tend to fit into a few common categories. They're obviously older. They're usually part of sibling groups, so there's a lot of children who need to be placed together. They're usually minorities, and they usually have behavioral issues, mental health conditions, physical disabilities. Those are the children who folks here in this country aren't lining up to parent. In Haiti, it's the same issue.
It strikes me that in many of these countries, it's an organic thing for
right. For
families to take care of each other. And if mom and dad die or killed in a conflict or something, that,
right.
that aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents automatically take them in.
Right.
We don't have that organic system in the United States.
We do, actually. This has been the really surprising and really thrilling thing for us coming to this country, because that was the big unknown. How are we going to simulate this cultural understanding of we care for our children?
Well, if it's true in this country, why are there so many kids in the foster care system?
This is the difficult thing. You have to look at who's doing that. Who's doing that organic, informal care of children is the African-American community, mm-hmm. the Black community. So the 71 corridor is the hot zone of quote-unquote failing families in KCMO. It's KCK and it's the west side of Olathe that are the other hot zones. If you were to go talk to a leader in the community on the east side of this city, and you'd come to him with these stats, he'd say, let's not talk about stats. Let's talk about names. Let's talk about people, because I know them. And he'll tell you the stories of the single mother in their church who acts as grandma to kids that are not her own. He'll tell you about the 18-year-old boy who's raising his younger brothers because mom died, and how the church is helping them. Poverty in this country is associated with broken families, not because poor people are more broken than anyone else. It's just that they have less resources to mask their brokenness. If you were to talk to the director of the children's division in Jackson County, she would tell you that over the last 2 years, they've taken in 20% more kids than they have been. It's a growing need. What the Global Orphan Project exists for is we look at the strengths that are already in those communities, specifically at the church, and we say, church, how can we help you do that more and do that better? In Haiti, they get to see the local church owning homes who were limited by square footage in their current residence as to how many children they could care for.
And so the goal is that these people who go to Haiti and go to other countries will come back and replicate some of those models in their
absolutely.
Communities.
Absolutely. And you'll catch that in the documentary that Mike Fox, the founder of the organization, touches on.
I want to encourage everybody to find something, if it's not the Global Orphan Project, if it's not the Children of Haiti, but to find something that they can get their arms around, that they can be an advocate for, that they can make it better than it would be if they didn't get involved in it. I want to encourage everybody that I know, get involved in something that's bigger than them.
To see someone in their own community opening up their doors and caring for children in their own community changes people. It's changed me in some tangible ways, and it's made me ask questions like, why do I live where I live? What does it look like to engage in the hurt of the single mother who is struggling to keep her electricity on? And she's at risk of losing her children to the child welfare system.
And what are your answers to those questions?
My answers to those are you just dive in. Don't close your eyes to it because it's overwhelming. When we talk about what we do here through Adopt KC, we expand the capacity of churches in these communities that these children tend to come from. We ask the church to ask their congregation, are there people willing to take in these children? If there are, then we ask the next question, what's keeping you from taking children in? Bar none, the answer that we're getting back is space. I'll give you a prime example. Macedonia Baptist Church on 31st and Linwood is one of our partners. They asked their congregation, who's willing to take in these kids? A woman raised her hand. She's already adopted two from foster care. She lives in a two-bedroom apartment. She can't do more. So what do we do with the church? We ask them, well, would you consider owning a home, a vacant, abandoned house? Can we renovate it with you? And then can you move this woman in there to care for more children? So that's the guts of the Adopt KC movement, is this expansion of the capacity of those who are already doing the work.
I have to ask you, do you have any foster kids?
Yeah, my wife and I do. One foster daughter and one biological son. The goal right now for this girl is to be reunified with her biological family. If the courts make the determination that her folks aren't fit for her to go back to, we'll be there waiting to make a lifelong commitment to her. But we're only able to do that, to be quite honest with you, because our church said, you need support. And that's what we hope things like the tour to Haiti drive in people, is this desire to, my community, my church could be that for hurting and broken families and you know, orphaned and abandoned children.
Thank you very much. Good to talk to you.
Thank you, Laura.
Tate Williams is the director of the Adopt KC program of the Global Orphan Project.
You can see a clip of the documentary and a link to the website for the Global Orphanage Project on our website, kcur.org.
Still to come, sitting in on Sharia classes on an army base in Kansas. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.
In Kansas, the Islamic code of laws called Sharia has drawn a lot of suspicion and debate during the past year. In May, the state legislature effectively banned consideration of Sharia in court, a move that some critics have called redundant and anti-Islamic. But Kansas is also home to a program that teaches Sharia in an unlikely setting, Army officer training at Fort Leavenworth. Alex recently sat in on a class and has this report.
As you know already from the reading, the 12th Imam goes into occultation or hiding in 940 AD, where he remains. I'll say a little bit about that in a minute.
Dr. Raj Bala spends most of his week teaching international and comparative law at KU, and he's become well known in Lawrence and around the country for teaching Sharia or Islamic law. Bala is actually the first non-Muslim to write a textbook on Sharia, which was published in 2011. But on Monday nights, his class is a little different. Instead of law students, the fluorescent classroom lights shine down on a room of 19 big short-haired men, most of whom wear military uniforms. Unlike your typical Midwestern L2, Sharia and Islam are not abstract ideas to these students.
Hi, I'm Major Pete Atkinson. I'm Special Forces Branch. I've been deployed to Afghanistan as well as Iraq.
Hi, I'm Major Michael Cochran. I'm a psychological operations officer. I've twice deployed to Iraq and twice to Afghanistan.
My name is Major Tom Craig. I've been deployed 6 times in Iraq and Afghanistan.
My name is Captain Arthur Varesh. Most recently in 2010, I was in Iraq. Before that, in 2009, also in Iraq, in central Iraq.
For the last 3 years, Dr. Bala has driven up to Fort Leavenworth one night a week to teach Sharia at the Command and General Staff College. His class is part of a graduate school program for mid-career military officers. Everyone in this class has been in the service for around 10 years, and they're all either majors or about to become majors. Most are Army, but other branches train here as well. The majority of the men in this class have spent most of their careers in the Middle East, and most will probably return there after graduating from this program. Realizing this, Raj Bala says it's vital these students have a complete and balanced understanding of Islam.
Some things that I say or do in class, I have to treat it, because it's quite possible, can make a life or death difference in a situation that I couldn't possibly now foresee. When they have to make a quick judgment about what or how to say something to someone in a foreign country. So what I teach them, what I say to them, really matters.
The Command and General Staff School, which is part of the college, is a pretty big deal for the Army. All majors go through this intermediate level training, and most of them do it at Fort Leavenworth. This is an intensive 10-month program which ends in a master's degree in global and international studies. Lieutenant Colonel Paul Schmidt explains that about 5 years ago, when the school wanted to upgrade its master's program, it decided to look outside its own walls.
We started talking with members of the University of Kansas, members of our faculty, and then members of the Special Warfare Center at Fort Bragg to determine what was most appropriate. a lot of this, quite frankly, is just part of where we've been in the last 11 years, which is the Middle East. So we thought that it was important to dive headfirst into what is Sharia law.
The college brought Dr. Bala on board to teach the very same Sharia class that he teaches at KU. It's a semester-long look at Islamic law and the philosophy and history that shaped it.
What's clear is that the Marja'iyya is giving only religious guidance, spiritual guidance. They are not getting involved in politics.
One evening, Bala lectures on the difference between Shia and Sunni Islam and how these denominations view leadership in the Muslim world. Despite the nuance and detail of the professor's lesson, the students seem to follow him every step of the way.
For the Najaf school, if our best and brightest will only provide religious instruction, who should lead? Because everybody else seems like to be a usurper or an imposter, the government. You know, even the Hashemite King of Jordan, all these guys are usurping the imam, but he's an occultation, so what
right.
are they supposed to do?
What
would Ali al-Sistani and the rest of the guys say about who should be the government?
Bala says that many of the militant or terrorist groups that the military encounters in the Middle East falsely claim to be acting in accordance with the teachings of Islam. He wants his students to understand the facts about the faith.
Much of what is proclaimed in the name of Islam and is used to justify violent actions is utterly un-Islamic. And so a key theme of the course is distinguishing what is authentically Islamic teaching and sound Sharia doctrine from what is not but proclaimed to be by people who are anything but Islamic, but yet pose a threat to our security and the security of our allies. That means that we have to delve into what the Sharia says and why it says it, what the rationales are for it and what the sources are for it, and then identify and isolate some of the, if I may say, deviant propositions that are not authentic, and then explain how they came about and how to deal with them.
The students in this program are part of Special Operations Forces. This includes elite units like the Green Berets, Rangers, and Navy SEALs. Some of the work that Special Operations Forces do is the high-risk ambushes and raids you see in movies, but a lot of it isn't. Special Operations Forces are also civil affairs and psychological operations. They work to stabilize volatile areas by developing economies and assisting local governments. They also work to counter insurgency. Dr. Bala believes that the work of Special Operations Forces can actually prevent warfare from breaking out in unstable areas.
When the Foreign Assistance Act of 1961 was passed in the Kennedy administration, and when the idea of Special Operations, which predates that, had sort of, you know, blossomed more, there were three basic pillars of what these folks are trying to do. You know, one is engagement with local populations. And that can be through the Peace Corps, it can be through civilian affairs, you know, working with the local populations. The second is development, because a lot of problems really are rooted in poverty. And the third is defense, right? And all of them understand that very well. That the defense component is one of three pillars in their overall mission.
So what I was going to say about the Ottomans and the Mughals, by way of introduction, is with the collapse of the Abbasid Caliphate,
Later in the evening's class, Dr. Bala's lecture turns to what he says is one of the more challenging topics to teach, literalism in Islam. In recent years, Islamists have increased their influence in the Middle East and North Africa. They believe that a strict, literal interpretation of Islam should be the law of the land. But Dr. Bala teaches that Islamists are just one part of a broad spectrum of beliefs in the Islamic world.
There's a lot of emphasis nowadays from recent events about literalism and reading a text that is accepted by adherence to it as the literal word of God, that it needs to be interpreted literally. But if we think about it carefully, something that is believed to be the literal word of God need not be interpreted literally.
Now, critics and some Muslim leaders have accused the U.S. military of being anti-Islamic, and they point to things like the abuses at Abu Ghraib prison as proof. But Raj Bala says he hasn't heard anti-Islamic sentiments from the students he's taught.
Absolutely not. I think they have a genuine intellectual curiosity and deep professional interest.
Bala says teaching the class is his way of giving back to people who serve the country. He also believes teaching Sharia has the potential to encourage peace around the world.
I really do believe, perhaps naively, that if we have better educated professionals, American professionals, out around the world, we can be a force for good and build peace and a tolerance through our better understanding of the people with whom we're interacting. Because what are the classic sources of conflict through the ages, right? It's a misunderstanding that leads to stereotype and prejudice, isolation, and conflict. And that's what we're trying to avoid.
For Casey Currents, this is Alex Smith.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
Schools across the U.S. are putting more fruits and vegetables on lunch trays and less meat and bread. But the changes, part of an effort to fight obesity, are getting a strong reaction from parents who say their kids are still hungry after they clean their plates. Grant Gerlach of Harvest Public Media explains why, for some schools and families, the changes have been hard to swallow.
It's lunchtime at Elmwood Murdoch High School in rural eastern Nebraska. After the bell rings, students race into line in a small gymnasium that doubles as the cafeteria. Behind the serving window, the trays are loaded with a fish patty on a whole wheat bun and a small pile of curly fries, maybe a smaller pile than last year, because the kids in this and other schools across the country are on a new diet. To get a handle on child obesity, the U.S. Department of Agriculture established new school lunch guidelines for the first time in more than a decade. Parents like Tracy Ziorian, who lives nearby in the small town of Manly, noticed the changes early on.
Gosh, I was starting to see some complaints from the girls last spring about the changes in the meals and not being enough food. And why are they only giving us 3 chicken nuggets when they used to give us 6?
Sitting at the kitchen table, Ziorian says most days she packs a lunch for Callie, a freshman, and Taylor, a senior. Maybe a salad or a sandwich, maybe leftovers or a pack of mac and cheese.
Anything that I feel can really suit that filling of the belly that they're not getting with the school lunches.
Here's why the Ziorians are brown bagging it. For the first time, lunches for high schoolers must add up to at least 750 calories, but no more than 850. Also, students have to take at least one fresh fruit or vegetable, and there are limits on meat.
I read that they're limited to 10 ounces a week, which takes it down to 2 ounces a day. That's nothing.
Maybe it's a Midwestern thing, but for Ziorian, limiting kids to 2 ounces of meat at lunch is almost offensive.
We are still meat and potatoes people. And, you know, when you're being forced on to become more of a vegetarian, something like that just doesn't sit real well with the rest of us.
You know, kids have been complaining about school lunch as long as I can remember from when I was a kid.
Marlene Schwartz supports the lunch changes as deputy director for the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. Schwartz says a lack of protein is not a nationwide problem, but obesity is. Around 18% of teenagers in the U.S. are obese and face a higher risk of heart disease and type 2 diabetes because of it. Part of dealing with obesity, Schwartz says, is changing the traditional idea that meat makes the meal.
The real problems are whole grains and fruits and vegetables and low-fat dairy. And so I think that the idea here was to decrease the amount of protein and really focus on making sure that kids had room in their stomachs for all of these other foods that they really weren't getting enough of.
Getting used to school lunches might be hard for some kids, but it's a challenge for the schools, too. Dan Novak is the superintendent of Elmwood Murdoch. He says the hard part is balancing healthy portions with student expectations. For instance, to keep meatball subs on the menu, the school had to cut the bun in half. Literally, the bun needed to be 1.5 ounces of bread instead of 3.
That is a smaller portion. I mean, you can say what you want, but it is a smaller portion. And so the kids remember getting the large Italian roll with the meatballs in it, and this year they got what looked like the equivalent of a hot dog bun.
At Elmwood Murdoch, sales of school lunch have fallen between 7 and 10% so far this year. Novak says when prices go up and portions go down, some parents get upset and send lunch from home, which may not do much for the obesity epidemic.
Those lunches aren't healthier than what we were serving last year.
Novak feels if the rules were flexible to allow a few more calories or a little more meat, schools could satisfy more kids and parents. Industry groups like the Farm Bureau and the National Cattlemen's Beef Association are recording that kind of feedback to possibly pitch changes to the USDA. A bill introduced in the House of Representatives would roll back the new rules entirely. But Marlene Schwartz at Yale's Rudd Center likes the rules as they are. She puts it on parents to make the most of the changes by working with their schools and their kids.
Part of parenting is being a little bit tougher and saying that, yes, I know, you know, you might be mad that you don't get as many chicken nuggets now as you did before, but here's an apple and that's better for you and that's really the right thing to do.
Back in the kitchen at the Ziorian house, Tracy's daughter Taylor speaks up on this point. She's the senior and she's not a fan of the new version of the meatball sub. Taylor just doesn't believe her peers can be forced to take up new eating habits.
When will we finally hit the point when a kid's going to choose an apple over a bag of chips? I think that's all it comes down to. I don't know if that'll ever happen because we're kids. You know, we're teenagers. We want to eat junk food. It's what we live off of.
It could be that battling obesity will come down to winning the hearts, minds, and stomachs of hungry teenagers. I'm Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
The Kansas City Rep's latest production, The Mystery of Irma Vep, features 8 characters of both sexes, including the Lord and Lady Hillcrest, their maid and butler, and a couple of surprise visitors. The license for the show stipulates that it can only be cast with 2 actors of the same gender, so it requires a dizzying amount of split-second costume changes which depend on both a skillful designer and dressers with laser focus. KCUR's Steve Walker has this report as part of our series, Artists in Their Own Words.
Charles Ludlam's satire of several theatrical and film genres, The Mystery of Irma Vep, may be one of the few shows that would be equally interesting to watch from behind the set. That's because its cast of 2, Mark Robbins and Ron McGee, play 8 different characters who, by evening's end, make up to 35 costume changes. Costume designer Lindsay Davis says the challenge requires a backstage team to ensure it goes off without a hitch and a creative approach to costume construction.
They go back and forth and back and forth, and the changes happen within a second and a half to 3 seconds, a majority of the changes. So literally they get off stage, the 3 dressers and the wig person attack the actors and make the changes. It's very, very impressive. But in terms of making it work, from floor to neck, the costumes don't close. So that literally means they are put on like a backward coat and then Velcroed up the back.
Davis also reveals another secret to some of the lightning quick changes audiences will see.
There's also a lot of underdressing in this show that a lot of the audience I don't think will quite perceive or pick up on, meaning that there is one costume that is on throughout a majority of the show and that the secondary costume goes on and off over the initial costume. So that's really helpful. For example, it's easy to cover up men's pants underneath a full-length gown.
One of the dressers for Irma Vep is Kyle Mowry, who also dressed much of this summer's Starlight season.
When does the show know it needs a dresser?
There are a lot of quick changes. I mean, quick entrances. When a person has to come off stage and come on within a certain amount of time, like a short period of time, 30 seconds, that's why I would say you need someone backstage to help them. You want to support the actor off stage so they can concentrate on being the character.
Whenever the stress of the actor is lessened, there is generally a dresser available to take the stress off the actor so that the actor can think about the important thing, which is making the next entrance and being, awake and aware and prepared to do the next sequence.
Kyle Mowry adds that before the costumes were even finished, Robbins and McGee donned muslin dummies of the eventual wardrobe pieces to work out the intricate details necessary to make the show look seamless.
I think of it as a backstage ballet in blacks. And we came in early, like 2 weeks before our tech, to rehearse. And we choreographed literally like a dance backstage. So when Mark or Ron comes to me, say to come out of a garment, we practice that and we say, okay, turn this way. And then you go this way and you do this. And I mean, it's really a choreographed thing.
Asked if he had a favorite costume in the show, designer Lindsay Davis waffled at first, saying you can't pick a favorite child, but then doubled down on one of Mark Robbins's beaded gowns. Steve Walker, KCUR News.
The Mystery of Irma Vep runs through November 18th at the Kansas City Reps Copagan Stage at 13th and Main Streets in downtown Kansas City, Missouri. For more information, visit the Arts and Culture section at kcur.org. The Artists in Their Own Words series is supported by the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency.
Coming up, scary sounds from Kansas City's haunted houses and a local Day of the Dead celebration. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. In area news this week, the Kansas City Chiefs changed quarterbacks, and a Johnson County grand jury ruled that a controversial statue was not obscene. But the story that got the most ink and airtime in Kansas City was an arrest in Colorado. Steve Bell recaps those and other top stories of the week on KCUR's Weekend News Review.
We notified the Ridgeway family this morning of this arrest, and we hope and pray that this arrest gives them some measure of closure in dealing with this horrible tragedy and loss that they have suffered.
Westminster, Colorado Police Chief Lee Burke. Family members, including the father of 10-year-old Jessica Ridgeway, live in the Independence area. Colorado prosecutors said the accused, 17-year-old Austin Sigg, had confessed to abducting and killing the girl. Meanwhile, Missourians feared the worst for a little girl who was abducted from her home near Poplar Bluff by a convicted sex offender. 5-year-old Amanda Berthoff was missing for about 6 hours before Darren Moore of the Poplar Bluff Police Department announced that she was okay.
You know, members of the Poplar Police Department, the Missouri State Highway Patrol, and the Sheriff's Department conducted a traffic stop on the vehicle.
Police said they found images of sexual acts with children on the computer of Jeffrey Shelton, the man arrested. In the trial of two men charged with torching the Hereford House restaurant 4 years ago and restaurant owner Rod Anderson, who federal prosecutors say hired them to do it, testimony included reports that Anderson had been heard saying he wished the restaurant would burn down, and testimony from the ex-wife of one of the alleged arsonists, who testified that he came home smelling of gasoline. Chiefs coach Romeo Crennel announced that Brady Quinn would replace Matt Castle at quarterback.
What position can change the dynamic the most? And that's the quarterback position.
He added,
I am not saying that Matt Castle is the reason we are where we are. That stroke of that brush is a broad stroke, and everybody's included in it.
The Chiefs had won only one game this season as Quinn assumed the starter's position. A Johnson County grand jury called by citizen petitions convened, then adjourned the same day. The panel said there were no grounds for any potential indictment over a bare-breasted statue at the Overland Park Arboretum. Kansas Governor Sam Brownback and Republican legislative leaders proposed a cap on property taxes. Democrats like Representative Jim Ward said that was okay with them.
If the governor is serious about property tax cutting, he'll meet with friendly faces on our side of the aisle who want to work with him to accomplish that.
Under the plan, if assessed values go up, tax rates would be adjusted downward to compensate for it. Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach joined a candidate for Missouri Secretary of State Shane Scholer as he toured the state, showcasing the centerpiece of his campaign, a proposal for voter photo ID. In the Kansas City area, Scholer campaigned in Lee's Summit.
I think just makes plain common sense.
Democratic opponent Jason Kander called the proposal extreme, unnecessary, and unfair. Meanwhile, retiring Democratic Secretary of State Robin Carnahan said all the talk about photo ID has some voters confused and emphasized that photo ID is not required in Missouri in the coming election, though it is in Kansas.
The rule and law in Missouri has not changed from past elections.
Carnahan said there have been no known cases in Missouri of anyone voting using a fraudulent identity. This is KCUR.
Halloween is just a few days away, and we thought we'd honor the esteemed traditions of the season by revisiting a classic Casey Currents piece from a few years ago. In 2009, in the middle of the recession, Alex took a trip down to the West Bottoms to meet some of the people taking seasonal jobs in the city's big haunted houses. Full Moon Production, which owns four big haunted houses in Kansas City, employs about 150 actors during the season between Labor Day and Halloween. Alex talked to cast members at The Beast to find out what it's like working in the scaring business.
After filling out W-4s and insurance forms, new employees at The Beast Haunted House are given a backstage tour of the five-story building. A few of the actors have returned from past seasons, but the large majority is completely new to working in haunted houses. Full Moon Productions Vice President Amber Arnett Beckwith shows one group through an indoor maze of trees and shadows called the Werewolf Forest. Here, one of the new actors already feels right at home.
My name is Hal Magis.
When you were here just for the audition the last week or two, what did they ask you to do?
Oh, they asked me to howl.
Could we maybe get a little taste of the howl?
The group is then led by an old freight elevator to a dressing room where makeup artist Keaton Cole tests out an angry, aged monk look on one of the new hires. In full costume, angry monk Ted Willard explains why he signed on for work at the haunted house this season.
I was actually a school teacher at middle and high school, social studies and science, but due to the economic downturn, I was having trouble finding a full-time job. So I thought, well, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
So what did they ask you to do at the audition?
That was the funny part. I wasn't really anticipating that. They wanted me to act like I was buried alive.
And once you travel through the werewolf forest, you enter into a laser time tower.
And in the Southern Plantation parlor room, Nick Paget, who runs his own theater design company in the off-season, prepares for his fifth year of haunted housework.
We say our applause comes in the form of screams, and once you get that first scream, you feed off that and you want more and more and more.
So are there any experiences with scaring people that really stand out in your mind?
It's funny to watch them lose it, especially the guys that are trying to impress their girlfriends and end up, they always throw the girlfriend in front. It happens all the time.
2009 is the 35th season for Full Moon Productions, which owns The Beast, The Edge of Hell, The Chambers of Edgar Allan Poe, and Macabre Cinema. Their houses are not only considered some of the best in the industry, but the flagship house, The Edge of Hell, was one of the first big commercial haunted houses in the country. Designer Shannon Yates has been part of the company since the start. Beginning in the late 60s, Yates and family were owners and operators of Summer's Moonglow Theater in the Ozarks. The family wrote its own plays, built its own sets, and starred in its own productions. But as Yates explains, the rural location didn't attract big audiences, and by the mid-70s, the family found itself in financial trouble.
We were in debt, and we thought that maybe we could help ourselves if we would do a haunted house like the service organizations did, like the JCs and so forth. And so we said, yes, let's try it. And we got more in debt doing that at first. But in the last week or 10 days of our effort paid off, and that was in 1975. So we went back to we had an outdoor theater, and we went back and got more in debt. Mm-hmm. So then we decided, well, if we're going to do this haunted house thing, let's do it bigger and better.
So in 1976, Shannon Yates and family started The Edge of Hell in downtown Kansas City. As one of the first professional haunted house designers, Shannon Yates has had to improvise his own methods, and he's learned firsthand what works and what doesn't.
Years ago, we had a place where a guy was supposed to be a bat, or half human, half bat. It was a terrific costume, but for it to really be effective, you had to hang by your knees upside down. Mm-hmm. And that's hard to do for very long. Had a guy hanging upside down, and he passed out and fell. Fortunately, he landed in the coffin below him.
Today, Yates and family work almost entirely behind the scenes, and he leaves the scaring to new hires. But Yates still loves the Halloween spirit that brings new employees and customers to the West Bottoms every fall.
If it's a good night and there's not something to fix or a problem to correct, and I happen to be going through the house and I'm in a good mood, once in a while I'll want to scare somebody again. Even if it's just like coming up, you know, on from the back when they don't know you're there.
For Casey Currents, this is Alex Smith. And as Halloween wraps up on the 31st, we look ahead to the following day. November 1st marks the day of the traditionally Mexican holiday Día de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead, a gathering to celebrate the lives of those who've passed away. The Nelson Atkins Museum of Art is hosting its second annual Day of the Dead celebration on November 4th, and Mexican artist Betsabe Romero and area artists have come together to create a special altar installation for the event. Reporter Julie Dinesche visited during the altar construction.
As the annual Day of the Dead celebration approaches, Kirkwood Hall at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art is bathed in an orange glow of light. The marbled hall has been lushly decorated with glowing paper lanterns, marigold garlands, and floating memorial altars for two Mexican artists who died in the past year. Mexican artist Betsabe Romeo directs a team from the Maddie Rhodes Center as they add bread, candles, and decorated bottles of tequila to the display.
I think you don't need to be Mexican or Latino to think about how memories are important.
During the Day of the Dead celebration on November 4th, visitors are encouraged to add offerings and memorials of their own to the altar.
I'm Jessica Manco. I'm the Gallery and Education Coordinator at Maddie Rhodes Art Center. I really love the idea, too, of how she designed the lanterns with the strings coming down to so that people that are coming into the space can also add their own memories to it, and I think that's going to help people connect, even if they're unfamiliar with this celebration.
Jenny Mendez, Cultural Arts Director of Maddie Rhodes Center. It brings such a glow to this area that's not normally here. The glow meaning of the color of the marigolds, but then also the light from the lanterns that are hanging. It seems somewhat delicate, but at the same time, powerful.
Visiting artist Betsabe Romeo says she hopes that her altar will break the boundaries between life and death, contemporary and traditional.
Street culture and museum culture can be together in this kind of celebration, and that's what is very rich.
My name's Judy Koch. I work here at the Nelson as Director of Education and Interpretive Programs. It's important to take a moment in our busy lives where we're really thinking about our schedules and what we have to get done and sort of stop and think about the contributions that people have made to enrich our lives that are no longer with us.
The altar will be on view in Kirkland Hall from October 26th through November 4th at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. Julie Dinesche, KCR News.
To see a slideshow of the Nelsons' preparations for their Day of the Dead celebration, go on to our website at kcur.org. Once again, we thank you for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast or find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at KC Currents.
KC Currents is produced by Suzanne Hogan and Alex Smith. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. Zach Lewandowski is our intern, and our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.